Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, over the next half hour, the human right to food. No one should ever go hungry. And in a new children's book, a tomcat tells the life story of his friend, who's now the Pope. And we go to the Pontifical Institute for Christian Archaeology for a historic trip back in time. When was the last time you went to bed feeling hungry? Well, chances are, if you live in one of the world's industrialized countries, you probably don't remember. But if you're living in one of the many places where food is hard to come by, it might be just as difficult to remember the last time you went to bed feeling satisfied. Well, on Tuesday, October 16th, countries around the world mark World Food Day, and this year, the right to food. Though that right may sound obvious to most of us, actually guaranteeing the right to food has mostly been left to individual governments. Internationally, though, the right to food has been recognized as a fundamental human right and was first recognized as such in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. It has been strengthened by subsequent international measures. Jacques Diouf is Director General of the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization, based here in Rome. He explains that 156 states accepted the right to food as a legally binding obligation when they ratified the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights.
Increasingly, the right to food is being written into national constitutions. It also features in legislative texts, regulations, and strategies. Social programs provide more ways of claiming the right to food, thus making it easier for all citizens to enjoy their rights. In this context, information is a key element. People need to be aware of their rights and of how to claim those rights. Officials need to know their obligations and how to fulfill them. While legal obligations rest with the state, all members of society, individuals, organizations, NGOs, and the private sector have responsibilities with regard to the right to food. At the 1996 World Food Summit, the heads of state and government reaffirmed the right of everyone to have access to safe and nutritious food consistent with the right to adequate food and the fundamental right of everyone to be free from hunger. They also committed to the full implementation and gradual realization of these rights in order to ensure food security for all. Despite the progress made, putting the right to food into practice still remains a challenge for countries and development practitioners. The right to food calls for a shift in paradigm from charity to rights, ensuring that every human being has an adequate and stable supply of food is more than a moral imperative or an investment with potential huge economic returns. It is the realization of a basic human right. And the world has the means to realize that right.
The head of the FAO's Right to Food Office, Barbara Eckwall, told me 850 million people risk going to bed hungry at night, and far more are not getting the right kinds of food they need.
There are 2 billion people who suffer from micronutrient deficiencies. For most of these people, the right to food is not being realized.
So you say the right to food is a human right. So therefore, for most of us, it should be a moral obligation to see that that food is provided for the people who need it.
Yes, it's true. It is a moral obligation because it is linked to the right to life. But it's not only a moral obligation. It is a legal binding obligation for all the states who have ratified the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, and these are 156 states.
But how are countries then held accountable for making sure that their populations have enough food?
This depends on the legal framework in every country. These are political processes also, which come from the citizens that they claim the right to food. There have been certain cases in court, India, for example, but also in Switzerland and other countries, which have been decided in favor of the right to food. But legal action is not the main focus. We should sort of focus on legal action not being necessary. That means that the right to food can be introduced already now at the programmatic level, at operational level. It can be introduced in policies and strategies that the countries are elaborating.
You, I'm sure, must have a dream for the future. Your unit is only, like you say, just over a year old. But what would you hope to achieve?
A world without hunger. And that can only be achieved if human rights are respected, protected and fulfilled everywhere in the world. A first step would be to achieve the Millennium Development Goals by 2015, but that is only an intermediary goal, because the overall goal is to eradicate hunger from this world. The world has the means to do it. It has enough resources to feed everybody today. So it should be done. It can be done. And I hope that World Food Day will give a lot of ideas on how to realize the right to food and will create a movement so that we can really realize it for everybody.
Barbara Ekwall is the head of the Food and Agriculture Organization's Right to Food Office. Chico the cat has a very special friend who just happens to be the Pope. In a new story for children, Chico recounts the life of his best buddy, Pope Benedict. The book, called Joseph and Chico, is an authorized biography that tells the story of Joseph Ratzinger from his birth in 1927 up until the time of his election to the papacy in 2005. Susie Hodges talked to the author.
The narrating voice for this book is based on a real ginger tomcat called Chico, who knew the then Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger when he returned home on his holidays to the Bavarian city of Pendling. Chico belongs to a German couple that live next door to the future Pope in Pendling and who still are the caretakers for his house there. The book has a foreword written by the Pope's personal secretary, Monsignor Georg Ganschwein. He said, "Dear children, here you will find a biography that is different to others because it is told by a cat, and it's not every day that a cat can call the Holy Father his friend and write his life story." The book's author is the Italian journalist Gian Perego, who lives in Bavaria and has met Chico and his owners. She told me what prompted her to write this book.
I've been reading everything about him. I met a lot of people. I went in his places. And since I have always written for children, I thought immediately, why don't I write this story for children? It's a very interesting story. He's an example, this person. He's very dedicated. So I said, he's a very, very good person that can interest the children, but I had to find a key to tell this story for children. So I thought that a cat could be the way. And what better of the cat that all the journalists at that time were saying, that's the Pope cat. It's not true.
Who then is Chico?
Chico is a red tomcat who belongs to the neighbor of the house of Josef Ratzinger in Bavaria, in Pentling. They are the caretakers and they are friends of Ratzinger. They still look after the house and this garden. And Chico is a big cat who had chosen at that time to go and stay with Ratzinger whenever he was going back home on holidays. And Chico was his friend in Bavaria during his holidays.
Now, what do these caretakers say about the Pope's love of cats?
They say that Ratzinger really loves cats, he really loves animals, he loves nature, generally speaking, and he used to love Chico, of course. When Ratzinger was elected, they went to Rome, I guess, to make some agreements with the caretaking of the house. And the first question that apparently Ratzinger asked them was, how is Chico?
So when the then Cardinal Ratzinger used to arrive at this house in Pentling, how did he react when he saw Chico? And how did Chico indeed react when he saw the Cardinal?
When Chico could see the shutters on, he used to run into the house of Ratzinger, welcoming him. And he was staying there all the time that Ratzinger was there. He really didn't want to go home until Ratzinger had left.
There's an incident in your book where you say how Chico misbehaved at once and scratched Cardinal Ratzinger when he tried to let him out. Is this actually based on a real incident?
Yeah. Chico's owners told me that one day, it was Christmas actually, some years ago, Josef Ratzinger wanted to send the cat out in the garden, but Chico was too happy to lay on the sofa, so he scratched Ratzinger's hand. But Ratzinger didn't get upset, only told the owners, well, he's a bit weird, this cat.
And is it true that he used to curl up on Cardinal Ratzinger's lap when he played the piano, for instance?
That was told me, and I could expect it because cats do this thing.
How did you manage to persuade Pope Benedict's personal secretary, Monsignor Geinstein, to write the foreword to this book?
I simply wrote to him. I sent him a copy of my text, and I asked him whether he wanted to write a few lines for me. And actually, he has done a wonderful thing. He wrote some touching words. I was really delighted when I got his text.
And do you happen to know whether Pope Benedict has read the book?
This I don't know. I wanted to make a sort of surprise for him. I wanted to send him the book as a present. He's my Pope, and this was a present for him.
What kind of person emerges at the end of this biography? What sort of characteristics do you think come out most strongly about the Pope?
Well, I think what I wanted to tell to my readers that Josef Ratzinger, Pope Benedict XVI, is a loyal, serious, dedicated person.
And presumably who emerges very much as a cat lover.
Of course, but not only cat lover. He is a very sensitive person. He loves animals, he loves nature, he loves to walk in the nature, and, well, but particularly he likes cats. In fact, in his house, I have not been inside the house, but I was told that there is a collection of little ceramic cats, and there is always the calendar of the cats, a calendar with picture of cats, that every month Josef Ratzinger brother, Don Georg, he goes there and he turns the page because it has always to be updated, the cat of the month.
And is it true that he used to prepare food for stray cats?
That's what I was told, and I would not be surprised. If you are a cat lover, I'm sure you do that.
And have the caretakers read this book, and what do they think of it?
They have not read the book, because the book is still in Italian, but I told them all the plot, all the story, and, well, they agree upon it. They were a bit surprised that I wanted to write about their cat, but they were pleased, because they love their cat.
And how old is Chico now?
Chico's 9 years old, around. Of course, we don't have a birth certificate.
So he was a stray cat?
Yeah. And it was adopted by the owners and by the dog of the family, Ingo, a golden retriever. But Chico is the boss. In fact, in the house, the nickname of Chico is the boss.
And what feedback have you had so far from those who have read advance copies of the book?
Well, up to now, everybody loved it. It's a nice, simple story of a wonderful person. And there is this trick of the cat, who is apparently a funny but lovely cat.
Perigo says that she hopes her book will help bring children closer to the figure of the Pope as a man, and through him to the Church. I'm Susie Hodges.
For more than 80 years, the Pontifical Institute for Christian Archaeology has been at the forefront of research on the earliest artifacts of the Christian world that spans over 2,000 years of church history. Located in downtown Rome near the Basilica of St. Mary Major, the Institute offers a PhD program for some 50 to 60 students. Charles Collins went to their offices and spoke to the secretary of the Institute, Dr. Olaf Brandt. He explains why, in 1925, the Holy See and the Pope first decided to establish a pontifical institute specifically for the study of Christian archaeology.
I think they felt a strong need for an institute of this kind, and it was the first archaeological institute of the Holy See after the Risorgimento, after the creation of the new Italian state, and the Italian state was creating its own archaeological institutions, and the Vatican, the Holy See, wanted also to have an archaeological institution. At the same time, this was a period when all the Catholic world looked for inspiration for renewal in early Christianity, in the writings of the Church Fathers, in the early liturgy, in early Christian culture and art. And that was why they felt a strong need for our institute. And that was why a first project was presented to Pope Benedict XV in 1918, who approved the project, but he couldn't realize it because they had problems with the war and whatever. It was eventually realized by Pope Pius XI in 1925, who himself was a scholar in this field. He had written an article about the Roman Church of San Sebastiano. He was a member of the Pontifical Academy of Archaeology, and he was the prefect of the Vatican Library. So he knew all these scholars, and he appointed them himself. He handpicked the professors of this first institute. He founded it himself. He himself drew up the plan for the building, and he followed the life of this institute very, very, very closely. On his deathbed, he said, if anything is mine, it's the Pontifical Institute for Christian Archaeology. And one of the men behind the creation of this institute was the priest who was responsible for the celebrations of the Holy Father, Monsignor Carlo Respighi, who had that position for many, many years, and who was also a member of the Pontifical Commission for Sacred Archaeology. So a lot of people around the Holy Father were interested in archaeology. The Holy Father himself was interested, and not only him, but the popes in those days were all interested in early Christian archaeology. It was a strongly felt need for this kind of knowledge, and the Catholic Church felt that the Church needed to have good scholars. They wanted excellency, they wanted a high level of scholarship in this field, because they wanted the truth on early Christianity, which is something which also, the general public today also wants to know the truth about early Christianity. I mean, we know what happens in novels and movies and whatever. I mean, that's something which modern man wants to know, the truth about early Christianity. And that was why this institute was so important in those days. And actually, our professors here, they teach everything from epigraphy, architecture, archaeology, catacombs, art, and whatever. But we also have professors teaching the history of ancient Christian liturgy. And in those days, it was the only place in Rome where you can study that. So many of the key persons in the earliest work on the reform of Catholic liturgy, they all studied here. This was where they learned everything on early Roman Christian liturgy.
Now, when you go through Rome, you go through the city, you see these famous places like San Clemente, you see the catacombs themselves, you also some of the lesser known places you might go to, for example, in Trastevere, San Crisogono, mm-hmm. there's a paleo church underneath that. But you read the history of these places, most of this stuff was discovered not long before this institute was established. Most of these excavations were happening in the 19th century. This was although ancient Rome, it wasn't discovered until recently. Was this one of the reasons that this interest in Christian archaeology developed?
Exactly. I mean, this institute was needed because they had already begun to make a lot of important discoveries, and there were excellent scholars and archaeologists working in the field. They felt the need for a center for scholarship where they could form and educate a new generation of modern archaeologists using modern methods. So many important discoveries and excavations were made just before this institute was created. Many important excavations were made and published by our first students. If you study the history of research in the different churches in Rome, you very often find that the first important step in this history is something written by one of our first students.
We talked about how this is, in some way, reading the church fathers in stone. What relation does Christian archaeology have with patristics, for example? I mean, what knowledge do you need to have of the church fathers to understand Christian archaeology? And what knowledge would you hope that people who study patristics have of archaeology themselves?
Well, we have also a professor of patristics here, so our students study some of that stuff. Of course, you should know something about both fields because they are completely different. Because when you study the writings of the church fathers, you study the deep, profound ideas of individual thinkers. What we study is the life of the Christian people, the structures, the physical structures, which tell us something about how the people lived and celebrated. What we study is especially important to understand the celebrations, the liturgy of the earliest Christian church, because the oldest complete liturgical texts are early medieval, but the remains of architecture, of church architecture, are older than that. So architecture is actually an older source to liturgy than the liturgical texts themselves.
Now, touching on this liturgy, you mentioned earlier that several of the people who were involved in the liturgical movement of the early 20th century were associated with this institute. Of course, liturgy is on everyone's mind now. The Holy Father has come up with a new motu proprio allowing the freer use of the 1962 Missal. One of the things he said was one of the reasons he wanted to do this was because he wanted to emphasize the continuity of the liturgy, the continuity of the 62 Missal, for example, to the 1970 Missal. What role do you think an institute like this has in putting a light on that continuity in the liturgy?
Well, I think it's important. I think it's very important to stress that there is continuity and that there is also continuity in the reform. I wish to stress that the work on the reform began very, very early, and that I think the foundation of our institute was part of the, so to speak, the foundations of this huge building. Pope Pius XI founded our institute in 1925. In 1930, the same pope made the first step of the reform, creating the historical section of the Congregation for Rites. And the people working in that historical section were people who have studied in our institute. So it's all connected, and it's all a long work. And I think it's a long process in perfect continuity. So I think it's important to realize for all Catholics that there is continuity between the liturgy today and the earlier liturgy. It's important to realize that the reform was not a rupture, it was not a break, but there is continuity. And I think it's also important to realize that the ideals of the people working on the reform in the 20th century, their ideal was to recreate, to reestablish the original, the traditional liturgy. They worked for tradition. They want to go back to the traditional, oldest Roman liturgy, which they described as the gold age of liturgy. So that was their ideal. That was what they wanted to realize. And their ideal was to allow modern Catholics to celebrate in the most traditional of all forms of liturgy.
Can you name some of these famous students of this institute that went on to work in the liturgical movement as it was known in the, before the council?
Well, I can mention two names. One of our first students when we opened our classes in 1926 was Franciscan Father Ferdinando Antonelli, who later became a cardinal, who was one of these key persons in the work on the reform. And he also worked together with another man who studied some years later in our institute, who was Annibale Bognini. It's important, though, to know that these men didn't work alone. This was a big process with a lot of people working and in close collaboration with popes. We'll say with popes because they began this work in 1930. The first commission instituted for the reform of Catholic liturgy was created by Pius XI in 1948 with these people, who then continued to work in different commissions and groups and congregations and whatever.
Can you tell us something about the students? You mentioned that most of the people here would be doctoral class students. How many students do study at the Institute? Where do they come from?
Well, I must stress that today our students mostly deal with archaeology and not with liturgy, but we have people working with liturgy too. We have between 50 and 60 PhD students on different levels. They have lessons for 3 years, and then they write their PhD thesis. And they come from many different countries. The biggest group, of course, is Italian, but we have people coming from different Mediterranean countries, from France, from the United States, from, I come from Sweden, I studied here. So we have people coming from almost everywhere, from Japan.
What's the relationship of this institute with other archaeology programs, both in other Catholic universities, for example, and also with the secular universities, especially here in Italy?
It's easy to say that, see, the students who come to us, they have studied in other universities because they must have their first university degree from another university. It's possible to study Christian archaeology also in other universities, but we are the most specialized center in the world for this field. So students who really want to continue with work and research in the field of Christian archaeology, they sooner or later they realize that they must come here.
Speaking of early Christian archaeology, of course, we're here in Rome, one of the centers of Christian archaeology, but there are other places around the world where you find the early evidences of early Christianity. How much of your work is centered here in Rome? How much do you study Christian areas in other places in Italy, but also outside of Italy?
Well, it depends. Of course, we teach about the entire early Christian world, the entire Mediterranean world. At the same time, as for research, I must say that we are perhaps concentrated on Rome and Italy mostly, not exclusively, but mostly, because the other important field for Christian archaeology is, of course, the Middle East, the Holy Land. But there we have the Franciscan archaeologist in the Custodia, the custody of the Holy Land, and they take care of that excellently, so they don't need us, so to speak.
Dr. Olaf Brandt is the secretary of the Pontifical Institute for Christian Archaeology. He was speaking there to my colleague Charles Collins. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.